What is going on, everyone? Happy Saturday. This is Jack Allen. We already have two people in the chat. Thanks for coming early. Man, you guys rock. I was worried because it's Saturday evening. You know, I'm not usually on the internet Saturday, but this is the only time I had to do it. So first, welcome everyone to another episode, Conspiracy or Just a Coincidence. I am Jack Allen. First, go follow me on all the socials. Twitter, Instagram, at Kojak Podcast. And if you want to follow my YouTube show, you guys are here, but listeners, Conspiracy or Just JAC. And that's it. So hopefully you guys are having a good weekend. I took off Friday, so I had like a three-day weekend. I've been chilling. I had to do all these notes today. So it's rainy here. I don't know how it is for you guys. I'm trying to think of anything new and exciting that we can like briefly touch on, but I don't know. I don't care. So today's episode, I'm so excited. So the book I have, if you're just listening, it's The History of Central Banking and the Enslavement of Mankind. Let me also make sure I tweeted, you know, everything's going on the screen before we get started. So I don't know if you guys have noticed, I'm back to live streaming on my, there it is, on my Twitter. So that's all set. But yeah, so this book, guys, it's so good. I highly recommend it. And obviously, each author obviously has a bias. So this author, he really did what he worked for the Federal Reserve or that like Federal Reserve type bank in South Africa. And eventually he got so disgusted with the corruption and the thievery that goes on, he left and started writing these books. Stephen, though, he was a little bit of his certain beliefs are not conducive to society in a way. You know, I always talk about this. I hate labeling things as an entire group. You know, that's just laziness. That's not true. But he does a lot of that. So I worked around what he says there. But the meat of the book is what's important. And that is how central banking has literally stolen any sense of like or any prosperity or cultural enrichment and just people feeling that they're good in their life or doing well. It's stolen all of that. Think of how many people we know that live in debt. I'm in debt from college that I didn't even graduate from. And thank goodness it's only like 9,000 or 10,000, but there's people with way more debt than me that got degrees in BS stuff because as an 18-year-old, you want $200,000 loan? Sign here. Do you have to prove anything? Maybe like, you know what you're going to do with your life, right? No. But if you were a business and you wanted to take a loan, oh boy, you're paying a bunch back. So it is just, or you're not getting the loan is what I meant to say. But it's just, so this book was awesome because it shows the transition between a central bank and a economy that does not involve the central bank. So one thing I really want to go over before we're going to start right with how usury destroyed the Roman Empire. Usury, oh God, all of it's just so disgusting. But one I wanted to talk about though is like, so we always say any like fiat currency is bad, which isn't the case. So this book will give you examples of governments that they controlled their currency. Napoleon is the example. He creates a paper currency that's backed by gold, but everyone can exchange the paper, kind of like how America was in the beginning until they removed it. But once you have a privatized bank, a privatized group of individuals that control the coining of money, that is where you get the issue. It's not the actual fiat currency. That's not inherently a bad thing. That works as long as the government is on it and they're making sure there's no making fake currency or, you know, manipulating their currency in some way that would devalue it. You need to be tough on that. But besides that, fiat currency isn't a bad thing. You don't need to be passing around gold ingots or silver ingots to have a stable economy. So I just want to get that. So Roman Empire, dude. Oh, fractional reserve, blah, blah, blah. All right, we're just going to get into it. And yeah, that's it. All right. And again, thanks for all these people already here. I'm like shocked. Saturday night. So thank you. Well, I'm glad you're back from your chores, Raven. Thank you. Thank you again. So, all right, let's start with Rome, the Roman Empire, which if you guys haven't watched, I know I'm not a big TV watcher. Lately, I've been like watching some after I read. And I get to, so it's almost like I get disappointed in myself for doing that. But I watched this one on the samurais on Netflix in Japan's history, which was awesome. And then I watched the Roman Empire one. And you should go watch it if you haven't, because I know nothing about the Roman Empire. Literally, I knew next to nothing. I know who Caesar was and all those things like that. But this does a great job. I, you know, get how Caesar came to power. I understand what he did and all this stuff like that. So definitely go check it out. But anyway, how usury destroyed the Roman Empire. So the monetary system of Rome in 753 BC to 565 AD, such a long empire, way longer than America is going to see, can be divided into three distinct periods where three different metals were used as a means of exchanging goods and services. And this is not to be confused like the Bronze Age, even though that's what these are called. It has nothing to do with historicals, Bronze Age, Iron Age, that kind of thing. So traditionally, Rome is said to be founded by Romulus and Remus in 753 BC in an area known as Latium. And according to legend, Romulus kills Remus to become the first king. All right, he wanted to be king. But around 600 BC, Latium came under control of the Etruscans. This lasted until 509 when the last king was expelled and the Roman Republic was established. The first money in Rome. Do you guys have a guess what the first money in Rome was? It was a cow. I should have my soundboard ready and hit move. So it's not acting as true money in this beginning stages of Rome, but it's like a barter system. And that lasts for like 100, 150 years. And then we have the Copper Age. And that's why I have this picture, if you're watching, of all these different Roman coins. So as the time went on, less moves, more monies. That was the joke I wrote. I need to get like a joke. I need to get a comedian on this show. If you guys know of any comedians, get them in here. We got to add some humor. My humor only goes so far. D-Berry sent a picture of a cow. Boom. That was, thank you for making my joke not silent, D-Berry. I appreciate that. So as they started using irregular lumps of copper and bronze called asrud, which means rough metal, they had to start being weighed for each transaction. So you're not just slapping a rock of copper in someone's hand or having to carry a scale with you, which wasn't a digital scale, obviously, which become very tedious if you're making lots of transactions. So Rome's growing. It's becoming the most prosperous city of the ancient world. And this prosperity was literally based on this uncoined copper system, later bronze, which was measured by weight according to a fixed system of units. So they're unifying payment. And here's the example of how it works. So this is issued by the Roman treasury in the form of ingots, full backing of the state, stamped with the government by D. Berry, a cow, an eagle, or an elephant. And I didn't look up if each one was that, but it'd be funny if like the eagle was the smallest, the cow is the middle, and also the eagle is the mascot of Jupiter. So it makes sense they put the eagle on their first coins. In 289 BC, the ingots were replaced by cast-leaded bronze coins, heavy metal, and they were paid into circulation by the state, and each had a symbol on it giving value. And this money, this is how, remember I just said fiat currency? So this money was based on law rather than metallic content. So even before, like any, you know, it's still BC times, fiat money was in existence. This metal wasn't worth the value that they were stamping on. It was obviously worth less, but because the government backs it, it's going to lead to the Roman Empire. So pretty solid. So this can be considered, I said my note before I wrote it, but now fiat is often criticized by Lalberts and Austrian economics, like Ludwig von Mises. If you guys, and I don't mean to, I'm not trying to, but if you guys probably have heard of the Mises Caucus, like Dave Smith, the comedian, is big in the Mises Caucus. He was an Austrian economist. And I'm sure you guys know that, but I wouldn't have known that until like I started reading. So I always like try to tell little things, but yeah. So fiat isn't inherently bad, especially when it's issued by the government and not by private bankers. That's the key distinction. And it's carefully protected, like I said, against counterfeiters earlier. So non-fiat is actually more challenging, gold and silver, because the price is set by private bankers. So almost the best option is a fiat government-backed currency, because just like I just said, so if you have gold and silver, that's what your economy is based on. Well, all somebody has to do, and they could be on the other side of the world. They could either find a new mine or they could buy up cheap gold, manipulate the prices, kind of like what JP Morgan does today. So you see look, isn't that just insane that our bankers control our fiat system. They also control our precious metal system. And I didn't have, if you're interested on that, how JP Morgan manipulates our silver and gold and precious metal market and the other ones. I did a silver, the big silver short or silver hoax episode. It's a little while back, but that was an awesome topic. A little out of the realm of like, yo, Brian, what's up? My Saturday night crew, dude, wait. I gotta, now we gotta use the soundboard for Brian coming in. Oh God, I should have been prepared. In your face, sucker, in your face, sucker. That's all I got, Brian, but I tried to give you something. All right. Raven says, stable and regular fiat good. Central banks that flood or restrict flow is bad. Dude, dead on. So now up to 300 BC, Rome was literally dominating. Unsurpassed increase in public and private wealth of Romans. After the conclusion of the Second Latin War in 338 BC, the defeat of the Etruscans, the Roman Republic increased from 2,000 square miles to 10,000 square miles, 20% of Italy. Isn't that also amazing that the Roman Empire started out as just a little town, right? Like that is, it wasn't even a unified Italy. Like I always thought when you think Roman Empire, you think Italy, which it became. But the fact that this one place was able just to expand and expand, I mean, truly amazing stuff. But so along with the explosion of land, the population grew from 750,000 to 1 million, 150,000 living in Rome itself. So a partnership was formed between the people and the Senate. And the Senate is known as SPQR. So I'm sure you guys have seen the shields and there's a lot of like Roman Stan accounts, which I love, but SPQR, it just means Senate and the people of Rome. Brian, no, it's fun. Thank you, Brian. You're funny. So the political leaders of this Senate at the time could be tied to how our republic started. And I know like people laugh and argue with me about being like a monarchist, but so this is another example. So Rome, they have a Senate. They elect the Senate. They're growing. They're expanding. People are doing better, prosperous. And the Senate is honest guys. It's virtuous guys. It's natural born leaders that you would want to represent your needs and desires and things that need to be fixed. But slowly but surely, loophole people come in. People, corrupt people see, wow, these people have a lot of power. I'm going to get in there and I'm going to do my bidding so I can get what I want. And that's the problem with republics. How do you stop evil people, corrupt people, degenerates from coming in to represent you? By voting? You think voting would stop that? Maybe in an honest society, you would believe voting would stop that. Oh, they would never vote for that scumbag. But it doesn't work in an dishonest society. Everything's a lie. So how do you know who's dishonest and who's honest? But anyway, so that's what SPQR means. I just didn't know that. The political leaders of the Senate this time, virtuous. So then, like I said, the loopholes are found, blah, blah, blah. So the Silver Age. So now you have the Senate going. They're starting to coin their own fiat currency, the government is. And that's what brings us into the Silver Age of Rome. So the traditional monetary system of moo and metal was changed in 267 BC when the patrician elite obtained the privilege to mint silver coinage. Some words in that phrase we probably don't like, patrician elite, but anyway, the temple of Juno Moneta is where money is derived from. Converted a sack full of silver denarii to five times its original value by simply stamping a new value on the coins. So they outsourced it from the honest, virtuous people to these elite people in the society. And what did they do? Well, this bag of silver that was normally worth $100, well, they stamped it. And they stamped it worth $700 or $800. Where do you think that extra profit went? Do you think it went to the people? It spread out amongst the poorest so they could be raised up or maybe divvied up evenly? No, the stampers of this money profited that extra $700. And this early Roman silver coin, the drachma, modeled on a green coin that was used in Greek, they had all these like denarius, half denarius, quinarius, all for the different values of the coin. The issue with this for Rome is there's very few silver deposits in the Italian peninsula. So if you switch your coinage now from this fiat system that we had with the honests, beginning Senate to this now not fiat currency, this precious metals currency that's value is, it's almost like a combination of both. You have people, you're going to get into issues. And so they run out of silver. So what do they have to do? They have to expand to get the silver. Sorry, my YouTube. Thank you for the new subscriber. Just subscribe. But the Roman peasants, they were the backbone of Roman expansion. They were farmers, they were military, and that was how Rome was so good, such a good military power. They could travel large distances because their farmers back home were getting all this food for them. They wouldn't starve, which we don't even think of today. There were no MREs when Rome was conquering. You know, they packed food. I don't know what you pack, but I guess salted meats, bread. I don't know, hunt. Crazy though. Could you imagine like walking to from Italy to France on salted? I mean, you better hope you have a good hunting day. Just crazy. I guess salted fishes. So food production, they're expanding. They got to get their military needs to be strong. They go with who they trust, their farmers. Well, now you're losing farmers that are giving the food for your military, all in the name to get more silver for this new patrician elite. So food production goes down because they're replaced their farmers by slaves from North Africa. So now you have a whole nother issue. You are now getting foreigners in charge of your food productions. Tensions are rising. They can't gain citizenship. What's their... Oh, Jay-Z asked, was the background always been this trippy? No, I just tried this, Jay-Z. Thank you for noticing. And for people listening, I want to like those starlights. I got it for Liv as a Christmas gift. And I was like, you know, I'm going to try it tonight. I see all the cool like streamers on the internet use it. So I'm going to join them. It looks cool. But yeah, so you have all these foreigners that are farming your food and they want to get citizenship. They're denied citizenship. They're treated like slave or like cattle or slaves, which, you know, isn't rare for this time. But when you treat people very poorly and they have no chance of rising up or escaping this horrible life they have, they tend to revolt or they tend to be lazy. If their fear, their only motivation is fear and death, they're the moment you light up off of that violence, they're done working. That's what happened in the Soviet Union. What's up, Barbara? Thanks for coming in on Saturday. I know Saturdays are a relaxing day for most of us. But yeah, so they're just treated horribly, the new farmers. And then until the Second Punic War, they weren't even allowed to serve in the army, which might have been a win for them. I mean, why would they want to be? I guess, though, in the military, you might have the ability to rise up if you're like a very brave soldier. Piracy become a major problem in Rome. Raids taking places, villas being sacked, travelers kidnapped. Violence had been an endemic, and there was no police force to maintain law and order. But the top dogs didn't care in Rome, the people coining the money, because they've got their own security force. So what does this sound like to you? So, you know, you have this new place. They're growing. They're expanding. They have honest people. They say, let's elect honest people to represent us. Okay, boom, we do it. Things are doing great. We keep expanding. We're getting so big that more and more attention, more and more people, and then new people take over. These people that have to say, you know what, let's coin money, let's print it, make it more valuable, let's manipulate the currency so we can get rich. Rome is going to be fine. They do that, and now there's chaos starting to ensue. All these things, they're expanding too much. They're putting food production in the hands of people who don't care. Crime is on levels unprecedented. Your middle class, your lower class is unsafe. They're getting killed. Huh. Now, but the elites don't care. Almost sounds like America if I think about it a little bit. Violence is endemic in Rome here. But so this reached a climax led by the revolt of Spartacus in 73 BC. So I didn't know that's why Spartacus, that was what that was based. So it was all this corruption and stuff like that in the Senate. So what happens? Oh, Raven had a good answer for us, just so we know. So Cushite slaves from North Africa, that's where the ones that were taken and stolen as children to be with the Roman slaves. And they would bring hard-track biscuits and dried meats. They were the primary marching food until the 1800s industry with tin cans. Damn, Raven, thank you. That's beautiful. So Spartacus revolts in 73 BC. I've never seen the movie, but he goes, I'm Spartacus. And no, I'm not, is it, Mike? So the big man, Julius Caesar, this man that I got on the picture, a guy who knew corrupt republic, who knew that these corrupt republics will end in empire. He was, and he became into power 100 to 44 BC, or that was his born. So he's born into an aristocratic family around 100 BC, and he was a lawyer before becoming a military commander who conquered Gaul, France in 59 to 52 BC, which is, so again, go watch that Netflix documentary, but dude, it was such an amazing story, dude. Like, this guy just took over. He just kept going. He wasn't supposed to cross this Rubicon. He crosses it. And I'm sure most of you guys know the story of Julius, but he takes over. He just does conquers a whole like country, huge part of Europe. And then he comes back. He and there's corrupt Senate still in control. And he defeats this powerful Roman senator, Pompey, in 48 BC. And now he becomes the undisputed leader of the Roman Republic. So this corrupt Senate, it still exists, but Julius Caesar is the top dog. And he rules with like an iron fist, so to speak, I guess. But he saw so many issues. And this is why, like I've almost, like I said, I've turned into like a monarchist. Because he returns to Italy, 45 BC. Caesar saw Rome crowded with homeless. Crime is everywhere. People forced off their land by usurers and land monopolists. 300,000 people had to be fed with the public granary every day. Usury was flourishing. The top had so much, the bottom had so little. What does that sound like again to us? History always rhymes. I'm sure I'm going to end up saying that another 10 times in the stream. But how many people do we think we have food stamps today? And granted, it's not like they're going to starve to death in America, but in Rome, they probably would have. But just these same issues that plagued Rome are plaguing us. Excuse me, I'm thirsty. So the principal, so they had these corrupt banking and corrupt politicians, but the principal users were charging interest rates in Rome as high as 48%. 48%, dude. That's like our college loan system. How do you expect people to better themselves if they'll never be able to pay off the principal? And that's what the goal is, right? These people weren't stupid. They knew if they gave this poor farmer a loan to survive, to grow crops for the next year, he's indebted to them forever. And that's what was going on in this part of Rome, in this time of Rome, till when Caesar came back. So there are two main political parties, the optimates, which centered around the nobility and the Senate, the privileged few, and the populares, who represented the citizens. Caesar, the OG, the boss, represented the latter. Caesar understood the evils of usury and how to counter them, and he created a national law against it, and how no class of men should withhold currency from circulation to cause panics. That has happened in America so many times to get us to the Federal Reserve, 1806, 1819, all these, I think you guys, if you guys watch all my shows, yeah, it is amazing. That's a beautiful line. Amazing how we consent to our own demise. So true, dude. But in America, J.P. Morgan, there was a crash, I think it was 1870 or something like that. And he pulls us out because he causes the run on the bank. He calls back these loans, or he talks smack on this other rival, like banker, a little guy. Everyone goes, he says he has no money. Everyone rushes to the bank. Panic ensues, and he saves the day. And the Rothschilds had a quote in the paper, "America's sure lucky to have a man like J.P. Morgan. He won't always be there without a central bank. Look at us in Europe. We're fine." And so this is what they do. So Caesar understood that they would manipulate the currency. They would lie. They were stealing from his people. And he said, "We're done with that. Out of here." Yeah, dude. Caesar was the OG, man. He absolutely was. Populist for sure, dude. So he created national law. He banned speculators could advance rates of interest or buy property. This was huge. So if there was a crash, Caesar says, "I don't care. You can't buy the property at pennies on the dollar." Banned. If there was like an emergency or a panic, you are not allowed to capitalize on that panic or chaos. Man, dude, man. So here were some of those reforms. They were just so good. Restoration of property was done at lower values. Remissions of rents were granted. Poor citizens / discharged veterans were given allotments of land to settle on. Free housing provided to 80,000 families. Soldiers' pay was doubled. their corn dole was like regulated. So you could, you know, somebody could get all the free corn or whatever. Provincial communities were enfranchised. So you're a farther away part of Rome. You're just as much a Roman as Julius Caesar is. The calendar, which had been neglected up to him, it was off by like years. I mean, no one took care of it. It was a mess when he came back from Gaul. He updates it to the Julian calendar, which we still use today. And this is a side note, but that Julian calendar switch from the Gregorian, I think it was the Gregorian. Oh, I could be messing these up. But whenever they made that calendar switch, that brings into question like a lot of dates that we always talk about in ancient time or what year it even is today. Because I don't know if they've done the math to say like, okay, well, we lost like 7 years with this confusion. I don't know. I just find that interesting always. Monetary reforms. State debt levels were reduced 25%. He took control of the mint from the patricians, the usurers. Cheap metal coins were issued as a means of exchange, that fiat currency, which the Lulberts will tell you, no, fiat bad. But just like I said, it's only inherently bad when it's the private bankers, it's privatized. He ruled interest could not be levied at more than 1% a month. See ya, college loans. College debt, gone, dude. You're out. You're out of here. Decreed interest could not be charged on interest, and total interest could never exceed the capital loaned. Awesome guy, dude. So badass. Slavery was abolished as a means of settling debt, which we talked about. Aristocrats were forced to employ their capital and not hoard it. Does our elite class hold wealth, or do they distribute their wealth that they have, or do they hoard it? Well, to have a good economy, your top dogs need to reinvest their money in people. They need to help. That's how you know that, like, all Amazon and all these companies, for anyone like that, not you listeners, you guys all know. Thank you. Brian was said I was right. The Julian calendar replaced the Papal Gregorian. Thank you. But if you had an honest country that you wanted to do well, you would not allow billionaires, maybe not even exist, but you would not allow billionaires to hoard their capital. Caesar saw this and said, no, you cannot. You need to reinvest. And you know what? You might make even more money then. But that is how, if you have an honest society, you wouldn't let them just store it like a Scrooge McDuck diving into that, you know, the gold coin swimming pool. Aristocrats, blah, blah, blah. So whenever you have a bunch of rich people running your country, corruption will ensue. And it's clear that you need an honorable leader, which I think will eventually happen to America. Once the people realize this scam that is being held over them, it's like the Federal Reserve, maybe we would all come together and say, wow, we need to stop this. This is just insane. They're killing us. They're putting us into slavery and chains we cannot see. We need to stop this. But until then, this will continue and continue and continue. And just like many stories, though, when an honorable man rises, the media kills him, the press, the rich elites, the corrupt ones, they know they can't have that. And so what happens to Caesar on March 15th, 44 BC? Oh, so he also built up like the Rome, like he was building all this infrastructure, these new public works projects to get people to work, blah, blah, blah. And then, after 4 years of assuming power, 60 conspirators stabbed him to death 23 times. And all these conspirators, they killed him because he was stealing out of their pockets by making sure corruption didn't run rampant and all these things. So, I don't know what your name is, Ike, but you were right. They openly tell you what they're going to do, but you are too stupid to do anything about it. That's what they said entrapment. That's what it is when they say entrapment is fraud. It's fraud. But yes, I don't know. I don't understand the last part. But I always talk about this. I know all of us know this, but they write books about what they're going to do to us. They tell us, but they know that we're never going to read the book. And so it's our fault, essentially, that we do nothing. So gold, the gold age is our final age of Rome. Starts in 27 BC. So Caesar died and deified, and the Romans adopted the gold standard. So you think that's a good thing, right? We talked about this. Thanks, Carl. What's up, buddy? So nice to see you. Now, you would think going on the gold standard would be a good thing, right? We always talk, conspiracy world loves talking about going back on the gold standard. And yes, it's better than this Federal Reserve fiat system we have. But as we said earlier, if you're on a pure precious metals market, it could also be corrupted and co-opted. But so they put the reason why the Romans put them on the gold standard was not to benefit the people. But see, because see, silver is the people's coin. Silver was used to pay for your bread each morning or your fish or whatever by all the regular folk. Gold was a payment for the elite at the hands of the top. And gold standard put it back into the hands of the elite at the top. Everything's based on a gold standard. They have all the gold. So it's hard. It's also harder to find and mine. There's less of it. Again, it puts it all in the hands of the top. Previously, gold in the Roman Republic was only issued in times of great need, like during wars, to make a big payment of whatever, a bunch of food or whatever. But and silver was the everyday thing. And now Caesar's death, they go right back to it. So this scarcity of gold would cause huge periods of deflation as a result of lack of exchange and circulation. More expensive, you hold on to it longer, or the elites do, right? You're not going to frivolously toss out a gold coin. You're going to hoard it because it's gold as opposed to silver. It was so scarce in 13 BC that the weight of the gold aureus, which was like their one payment, was reduced from 122 to 72 grains because it's rare and they're hoarding it. Metals continued to flow eastward to pay for luxury items, spices, silk, whatever, everything luxury. So the small amount of metal they have now that's on the gold system, is it going in Rome for infrastructure or for public works projects or the people? No, it's going, like globalization, out of your country, out of your people's hands, and into foreigners' hands. Does that better Rome? Does that better America? No, obviously it doesn't. Also, religious dues was taking a lot of the wasn't taking a lot of the gold and usury payments. So wear and tear also results in a third loss of total coinage over 3 years. 3 years they lost, or 100 years they lost a third of the coinage from wear and tear. So I wonder where it all went. I guess it could have just fallen off in like pieces or whatever. But so gold was treated as a commodity in Rome. Debasement was not tolerated. And Emperor Constantine, he's 275 to 337 AD, personally ordered the death for counterfeiting and burning of public minters who committed fraud. Any money changer who did not report a counterfeit was flogged, enslaved, and exiled. And so in 1313, Christianity was tolerated. In 30 AD, it was established as the official religion. And from this time, the monetary power resided in the religious authority of Pontifex Maximus. So I don't know if that means that the Pope was coining the money in like 300s Rome, or if it was just, I don't know what that means. Sorry for writing a note that I have no idea, because Pontifex Maximus, we talked about that in the Jesuit episode. That's what they called like the new Caesar character, because Caesar became deified, and eventually the Pontifex Maximus went to the Pope's title plate in a way once, Rome fell. So yes. Oh, and yeah. So the Roman businessman was not like a trader or anything, like a merchant. He was a looter of the provinces. As homeland, he had a weak. They had we had a weak industrial production base. So that's why they were going to other places, because they had no industry in Rome. Huh? I wonder where else that is the empire that has no industrial production. Oh, that's right, America and Europe, for that matter. So so what was the role of the church in the decline and the fall? So Constantine decreed one tenth of an income had to be tithed, which possibly quickened the destruction of the Eastern Roman or the Western Roman Empire. So eventually, remember how we just talked about, oh, D. Barry says, imagine being the Pope and the president simultaneously, Giga Chad. Yeah, dude, that's some power. But so the church, which I'm a Christian, so tithing, I'm not like anti-tithing or anything, but just how we just mentioned that the elites of Rome were hoarding their wealth until Caesar said you couldn't do this. Well, when you tithe, do you think what's the church doing? is the Roman Catholic Church, are they, what are they giving it to their poor members of their parish? Are they using charities with it of the one-tenth of the income that they're getting sent? No, they were hoarding all of it, buying land, buying property, making investments like a bank would do. And eventually, and this is another reason why Western Rome fell, all the church had one third to one half of all land and all wealth. And what were they doing with it? You know, like acting piously and recycling the tithes money into the communities. No, no, no. What were they doing? They were hiding these vast hoards of gold behind these walls, these 20-foot thick walls of the fortress city of Constantinople and the Vatican fortress in Rome. That's what they were doing with all this wealth. And so the last years of the 5th and 6th centuries of the Roman Empire, it became a parasitic organism. The economic ruination preceded its political ruination. And I think that's probably pretty common most places, that you're, before your political system collapses, you need to have an economic collapse. And we have that. We're on our way there. I don't mean to be like real negative. I'd say it kind of laughing. I'd look forward to the day that our economy is, I don't know what happens. I mean, it's an exciting time, right? All what I would say is just try to be as prepared as you can. I have some listeners. I don't think he's here tonight, but Josh, he's like a real, he can build things. He can make things. That's what I got to do is learn. That's how we prepare for the collapse, is have skills. I don't really have any skills, but I could lift weights. I could be a laborer, could move things. So no industrial production. That's us. All food had to be imported. Well, I think we grow still some food in America. Usury was practiced on an unprecedented scale. The wealth of the Roman Empire, not held by the church, which was a third to a half, was controlled by 2,000 Roman families. The rest lived in poverty. I don't need to say it, but we have that today. We have that exact, our middle class is being ripped from us day after day. The implosion of the western half of the empire in 476 AD by repeated attacks of the Goths and the Vandals, who were, and I didn't know this guy, so I'll tell you, thanks, my friend. Your name confuses me. I don't know what to call you, so thank you. But so the Goths and Vandals, I didn't know who those were. I always hear those names, and so I'm not trying to, again, belittle you guys. And here's more of the walls. If you're listening, I have pictures of the Constantinople walls, which were hoard, where all the Roman Empire's wealth held, 20,000 or 20 feet thick walls. And there was that big siege, which I know nothing about, so I'm sure that's why it took so long. But so the Goths and the Vandals, I have a little photo of them. They were Polish people, like modern day Polish people and modern day German people. And they just kept attacking the Italian Rome, and they eventually seized it and sacked Rome. This supposedly resulted in the alleged Dark Ages. I did an episode about how the Dark Ages were fake. I don't know. Ism, you got it. I'll call you Ism. And Vatican and Roman Empire is a disguise of a religion. They're the same merchants and slavers that killed Julius and Kushites in Egypt. Yeah, Raven, I like starting this. I forget what book we were talking about a few days ago or a few like shows ago we were doing. But whichever one it was, it talked about how I think it was about the Arkids and how all these families came from Venetia. These Venetian bankers were disgusting. They just taxed everything, interested everything. And those same Venetian bankers, the ones became the shifts that roomed with the Arkids in Germany. And a lot of their family, they moved north after the fall of the Roman Empire. They moved to continental Europe or more, you know, northern Europe. And they just changed their names, which is I find that very interesting. So there's something there. It's very odd. It's like it runs, you know, this century long scam. But anyway, we're going to pretend that the Dark Ages happened in this story because I don't know, but maybe they did, maybe they didn't. But the metallic money of the Roman Empire at its height was $1.8 billion in currency. By the Dark Ages, it went to $200 million. Agriculture was reduced to subsistence level. No trade. Commerce stagnated. Arts and sciences were lost. Supposedly, cement making was totally forgotten. I find this hard to believe. I find this hard to believe. And if you guys are interested in it, look up Emmett Scott and the Dark Ages, the Phantom Time, the Dark Ages scam or Dark Ages hoax or something. Emmett Scott, or DM me. I'll set you up with the book. Great book. Great book. But anyway, we're going to pretend the Dark Ages happened. So the major factors in the decline of Roman Empire, we talked about it. Concentration of wealth, absence of mining deposits, no industrial production, importation of foreigners as slaves, which removes cohesiveness and social values, and slaves outnumbered Roman citizens in Rome 5-1. That's not good odds. I'll tell you that. It's not good odds. The big economic reason was inadequate supply of circulating money. A dishonest economic system will contribute to the forces of dissolution. No society can survive a false economic system. And that's Sue Key. We're going to see if we can. We got it here. So for any society to function and prosper, its absolutely fundamental means of exchange need to be issued debt-free. If there was no debt, if there was no usury, if there was minor interest rates, 1-2%, this would be a completely different country, completely different. If we didn't outsource our money printing to corrupt bankers, to a private and semi-private entity that doesn't need to tell you anything, the people were just so stupid. Not you, not us, but our, like, if you asked any of like my people at work or wherever, where you live, your, maybe even your close friends or family say, do you know what the Federal Reserve is? They wouldn't know what the Federal Reserve is. If you told them what they were doing, how their $1 can be loaned 10 different times for that same dollar, they would be shocked. But they'd rather memorize who can hit more home runs in 2019 or whatever, whatever. So that was how Rome fell. Next chapter, England. And this is where we really get into like the meat and potatoes of the central banking, because everything comes from England with this central bank. So this picture of this guy I got up that's looking very dapper for everyone. He's wearing a top hat with a nice goatee. He was the Prime Minister of Great Britain. His name was, oh my God, I didn't write it down. Oh, but his name is PM Disraeli, Benjamin Disraeli. So this guy is Benjamin Disraeli. He had the most beautiful quote. He was calling out all this corruption, and I think they killed him at some point. But all great events have been distorted. One of the most important of causes concealed. If the history of England is ever written by one who has the knowledge and the courage, the world would be astonished. What a badass. What an amazing quote. I might tweet that later. You guys can use it too if you want to steal it. But again, Benjamin Disraeli, that was his quote. So let's go to ancient England. Ancient England. So there's this King Offa. I got a photo of him. Obviously, it's just like a painting of King Offa. He ruled the kingdom of Mercia, and it was one of seven autonomous kingdoms in the Anglo-Saxon heptarchy. Find the wealth. Will do anything to correct. Ism says how class war seems more relevant than race or religion. Yeah, I totally agree. He was poisoned. Raven, you're coming with all these crazy facts. So Benjamin Disraeli was poisoned. Damn, the guy that I just read that quote from. Crazy. All right. So King Offa, this guy, he was a wise and able, kind king of Mercia. He established the first monetary system of England. He realized the scarcity of gold and used silver for coinage and store of wealth. Smart guy so far. A pound of silver was divided into 240 pennies. They were stamped with this old star, English sterara, which sterling is derived from. And being this based leader that he is, based for anybody that doesn't know, means like traditional, kind of. Based, but Offa banned usury, charging interest in money lent in a practice which dated back to the pagan era. So this has been going on before. This is Christian England at this time, or somewhat, and he says, no, we're not doing that. So laws against usury were further entrenched by King Alfred, 865 to 99, and then things are going well in England. All right. We're building. I'm English. We're building up. We're doing well until 1000. Then 1050, Edward the Confessor decreed not only forfeiture, but that a usurer should be declared an outlaw and banished for life. Damn, Edward, that's ballin'. And then but like any rising society, just like we had in Rome, it's going great. Oh God, I'm not here. It's not going, I'm going up the hill. We're doing great. We're reaching the apex of society. Chug, 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 chug. And as you get to the top, there's like people that sit right at the top of the mountain. They start jumping on the train, pulling it down with corruption. And that's my metaphor for like what happens to societies. They go great. They go great, honest, virtuous. Everyone jumps in. So 1050, England keeps going on the up and up, but usurers keep trying to cling back, cling in, find loopholes. And I guess that's just people, right? Everyone wants to jump on the bandwagon and get theirs, or maybe they're just corrupted people. I don't know what it is, dude. I don't know what it is. So in 1066, England started to change. William the Conqueror is from Normandy. William the Conqueror was financed by some wealthy individuals to dispose of King Harold II, and his financiers were rewarded for this financing. Obviously, usury is back, baby. Thanks, William the Conqueror. And they're protected by their purchased king. Let's see if I have William the Conqueror. Oh, no, it's the next guy. And as always, the regular folks suffered. The new king and his bankers charge interest rates 33% a year on lands mortgaged by nobles, 300% on loans of tools of trade or animals. Within two generations, that's all this takes. One-fourth of all English lands were in the hands of the usurers. A fourth of land. How much of our land today is in the hand of BlackRock and Bill Gates and all these people? This isn't a serious society. If you are trying to make if this isn't a serious empire or whatever you want to call it, because it won't work. It won't work. And people that like these can't, like Caesar and all these people we talked about in today's world, if they existed, maybe they're in some third world country like Libya or they're wherever, Afghanistan, and they have a leader like this, they'll get called a communist. They'll say they're poisoning their own people. All the normal things that our press does constantly. So all these interest rates within two generations, all the lands are gone to other people. And at his death in 1186, Aaron of Lincoln, this guy right here, was declared to be the richest man in England. His wealth exceeded that of King Henry II. And he was one of the big bankers. One of the big bankers. Get the Patriots to die for your greed. Dude, so true. So true. So true. So along with the new imported usury, this new class, like, you know, one person sees somebody making money through this stuff. They come from it. They say, wow, you should come here. We can keep charging high interest rates. And they say, okay, yeah, I'm going to come on over there. So this whole new class of people start coming in here. And it frustrates the English merchants. Not only are they now being charged huge interest on any loans they take, they start doing with new people come new ideas. And so these new merchants or bankers, they started doing like a supermarket of the olden days. So instead you used to have, you know, a baker and a fisher, whatever. You had to go to each guy that employed five people for your goods that you may need. Well, they had this supermarket idea, so now one person controlled all these goods, and I'm sure was able to undercut the individual selling. So now you're not only getting charged interest, you're losing business, you're losing customers, all because of this new king that's just allowing his financiers back into the country to do whatever they want. So this new banking class, not only did they do all of these things that we just talked about, they also started clipping silver coins and melting them into new bullion, plating tin with silver to make more fake currency. So now you're debasing the currency. And when that gets found out, shit's going to hit the fan. So by the beginning of the 13th century, many nobles were in danger of losing their land through usury and taxation. So onwards to the 11th century with the immigration of this, all this usury and economic development is totally halted. And not only that, in 1207, $60,000 in taxes were levied on the Christian population. It's just, they were the only ones that got hit with it. It's just so weird, dude. Like that's what, again, that pushes me more and more to Christianity each time I like read and all these things like that, because it's clearly attacked constantly. No other religion is allowed to be intact like that, but Christians. So why is that? And if they make jokes, and but you imagine them making a joke about Muhammad on SNL, they would never do it, ever, ever. But yet they can make one about Jesus. Why? Because there's fear there. There's like this. It's our tradition. It's our traditional religion of America, or whatever. It ties us to roots that they don't want you to have. They want you just to be this soy boy, Marvel watching, believing in Iron Man's going to come save you, as opposed to living the truth that's in the Bible. So nobles who borrowed from these new bankers or from the corrupt king, they would have their mortgages on a treasury roll. As soon as that the money lender ran out of money, or maybe the king was in financial trouble, they would just go in and steal your land. They'd say, it's ours now. Sorry, you borrow money. I know you're paying it back, but we're going to take your land anyway. Ism says, imagine following someone that could not care less about you. That is what we do as a collective. It's so infuriating. Dude, I talk about that all the time. You're so right. So right. So anyway, So King John, that was 1119. Let's see if I think I got a picture of King John. So King John, this is real important. 1199, 1216, lived a depraved life. He was doing whatever he could to help his banking buddies. And in 1215, a historical event that I heard about before, the nobles revolted because they're getting their land stolen. There's corruption to high heaven, interest, usury. So the nobles revolted and they forced King John to sign the Magna Carta. So the Magna Carta, I heard that before, like in school when I didn't pay attention. So the Magna Carta, it was 61 clauses relating to the establishment of various constitutional and legal rights. So you could think of it as like a constitution. But its principal purpose was to cancel the bonds of the moneylenders and to abolish usury and the privileged position of these people, the moneylenders. So a year later, King John dies. He's succeeded by his 9-year-old son. And 19 of the clauses that were about usury, were about this corruption, were removed. They were removed. So the main reason why the nobles revolted gets removed. And then 1233, new statutes were passed that abolished all forms of, so then people got sick of it again. 1233, another like Magna Carta-esque thing was written. And now all loopholes were closed because the people probably said, well, they got around this one this way. You get it. So by 1290, all usury banned from England. Anyone that practiced in it, exiled, threatened. They had until a certain day. If you were a moneylender or a usurer, you had until a certain day in 1290 to leave. It was All Saints Day. If you did not leave, they were going to kill you. Immediately that usury was gone. Taxes were lessened. No state debt. This interest-free tally stick was used for government expenditures. I put a picture of if anyone's interested, but they would give to the borrower and the lender two same sticks and have notches on it and symbols and things like that. So you knew how they would pay back. And that was like, you could go to court and say, see, we both have the stick. He owes me or something like that. I don't know. But anyway, they used these sticks, and these sticks though were still in use until 1783. I mean, this was a good idea, apparently. I just don't understand, but they must have been. They were used to finance infrastructure, public buildings, ports, dredging up new ports, making the ports bigger. And in 1694, guys, 17 million pounds of these sticks was still in existence that people were still paying off. But so this was, and we said that they kicked out usury. What year did we say? 1290. So from 1290 on, they had tolerable taxes, no state debt, no interest to pay. England enjoyed a period of unparalleled growth and prosperity. You want to find out how England became the dominant force it was? It was because they had 400 years of honest economy, of wanting the best for their country, of wanting the best for their people. So they just kept growing. This was a crazy statistic. Oh my God. The average laborer only worked 14 weeks in this interest-free England. They enjoyed 160 to 180 holidays a year of not working, of holidays and families and feasts, et cetera, et cetera. It was an England enjoyed a literal unparalleled growth because of this time. And they're not even working these 40-hour weeks that are known to America. And this may be hard to believe, but the men of the 15th century weren't just living in squalor. Yes, they didn't have a television or a cell phone, but they were paid relatively very well. Their purchasing power didn't decline because it wasn't this fake manipulated economic system. And their standard of living would only be exceeded by the late 19th century. That's how powerful. They could provide family, good clothes, meals, had meat and bread. And by the 13th century, when Europe is beginning to build their new world, and this new world was the world of these agriculturalists, these farmers, these, you know, bottom socioeconomic level groups, this was their Europe, dude. They were building these structures. They were making Europe so successful because there was just an honest economy. And an honest economy means it just goes into every facet of our lives. And so I know everyone's big on Tartaria, and I don't know where it exists today. But anyway, these beautiful structures like this one in England was built in the 15th century. I mean, let's see if I can make it a little bigger. Just beautiful. I forget which one this one's called, but these are breathtaking structures. Breathtaking. And also in the 15th century, land was almost entirely in the hands of farmers. It wasn't controlled by five people at the top. Thanks, Ism. I like you too. And during their spare hours, they were building some of England's. So, you know, all these days off, they weren't just smoking weed and watching Netflix. They were building these churches and building this infrastructure for their country, for they wanted to see the best world that they could make. Could you imagine in America today, if they made the rule, all right, 20 hours a week is all you need to work. You'll have enough to feed your family and maintain your lifestyle. What do you think would happen? Do you think that people would go out and build these beautiful churches or build, what do people love? Build a beautiful sports stadium? No, dude, they wouldn't. They wouldn't. I mean, think about how people are on welfare and food stamps these days. What are they doing with all that free time? They're doing nothing. So something's happened to us, right? And I think it's the loss of God. I think it's the loss of family. I don't know. But that's what they did in their spare time. They built those churches. And like I said, these cathedrals were reinforcing the tenets of this Western civilization that without leisure time, fostering culture is not possible. And maybe that's why we're so devoid of culture. Because in our leisure time, we consume, produce culture, as opposed to going out and interacting with our people, our communities, and creating a culture. We just listen to whatever Tavistock pumps out. Thanks. Oh, you guys are giving me so many nice compliments. Thank you, Raven and Ism. Wow, so nice of you. So these were the most beautiful creations known to man, right? Like we all look at them today, and even up to like the 1800s, we see these beautiful structures. Like, wow, how did they build it? There's even a theory that they didn't build it because they're that beautiful. But this, and I also think it's a beautiful metaphor because we modern architecture, it'll be like some exposed beam that's like in a cube in glass windows everywhere. And that guy went to college and got a 4 or 5 year degree to build that. But these people were literally farming as their day job. And this was their leisure time. And they built these breathtaking cathedrals. Ooh, I need another drink of water. So when did this golden age of prosperity come to a tragic end? During the 17th century, as always, so we, you know, England's going up, we get hit with a bunch of usury and money lending, we start going down, we remove that issue, go back up, it happens again. It's just like a cycle, I guess. So a lot of the money lenders that were in England, they went to Spain, and Spain eventually they banned usury as well. Again, all these beautiful churches. So a lot of this type of banking and everything, this unscrupulous business activities, they go to Amsterdam and Holland. And the Dutch at the time were a very important maritime power, but small. And these recently kicked out of Spain were now in Amsterdam. They desired to return to England because there was more people, more money to be made than Amsterdam. So Queen Elizabeth, 1558, 1558 to 1603, had an influx of self-described Christians settling in London, and many of them were practiced goldsmiths. But this is, So they would accept these goldsmiths that came in 1558. So usury is still banned, but they would accept gold for safekeeping. Okay, so they're like a gold bank. I'll take your gold. Then they would issue 10 times the amount of gold as gold receipts to, which is our fractional reserve banking system, which I'm sure many of you said, huh, that sounds like a fractional reserve banking system just with gold. And it is. It's exactly that. So this usury started seeping back into society, with interest going up to 33%, even though the quote unquote legal rate was 6% and a year. So how are they, again, loopholes. Ism, you don't need, that would be kind of you. You don't need to do it. Don't worry, buddy. I know I'm not getting fit. Ism said, should I share your channel? I don't want state actors coming. And I dig you, dude. I agree. We don't want any weirdos in here and people trying to catch us. So accepting the gold for safekeeping and then issuing 10 times the amount of gold as receipts, like we just said, fractional reserve banking system. So who bore the brunt of these huge interest rates? Was it the king? Was it the nobles? Was it the bankers themselves? No, it's how it always is. The lower working class, us, the blue collar group. So in 1534, by act of supremacy, the Church of England was established as the official religion of England by King Henry VIII. And the Stuart King Charles wished to maintain the preeminence of the Anglican Church, came into conflict with the Puritans. The Puritans, I'm like a Presbyterian. Truthstream Media did a series called Trust the Game, a creation of the central bank. I'll have to check that out, Raven. Thank you. She said they did a history. I'm sure this topic's been done. I just like this book. But anyway, I keep talking to you guys. I'm focused. So Puritans are growing in Britain. People are upset with the Catholic Church, blah, blah, blah. And they're proselytizing people. They're getting a huge group of the population, because what they're telling them is like, you don't need to do all these crazy sacraments. You don't need to read the Bible in Latin. You just need to read the Bible, pray, and you'll go to heaven. And the story is important because the bankers so there's a divide happening in England. You have the Anglicans versus the Puritans. And this is going to be very important, where this is like how history rhymes. The elites, the predator class, they see when there's a divide, when there's strife, when there's conflict, they can get away with what their plan is. That's what we see here today in America. So you have these two groups, the Protestants versus the Anglicans. They're hating each other. And in 1640, one of the leaders of this of a community, Fernandez Cajarval, he was a merchant, he was a spy, he was a moneylender, organized a militia of 10,000 operatives to spark chaos across the country to capitalize on this strife. Civil war soon followed between the Royalists, which were the Anglicans, and the Roundheads, which were the Puritans, lasting from 6 years, 1842 to 1848. Oh, here's King Henry. We already talked about him. So here, this is what we're getting into right now. So the Civil War, we just said that. So the Roundheads were victorious, and 190,000 or 3.8% of the population, died. So it was a huge civil war in England. So it was against these guys, the Anglicans. For those listening, the one looks like a pot, like Captain Blackbeard in the old Peter Pan movie with Tom, or with, who is that? The guy that killed himself. Oh my God. You know what I'm talking about. Hook, that movie. And the other guy looks like he's wearing an old timey football helmet. So they were the Protestants, the old football helmet, and the Anglicans were the fancy swashbuckling Captain Hook character looking character. But the Protestants won. So the leader of the Roundheads, the Protestants or whatever, was called Oliver Cromwell. And Oliver Cromwell, here he is. As a Protestant, I thought, oh, maybe I was reading. It's like, all right, Oliver Cromwell, he's my guy. He's a Presbyterian or something. And then when I read the next page, Oliver Cromwell's new army was outfitted, provisioned by the professional moneylender, agitator, the guy that I talked about, Fernandez Cajaval, and bankrolled by him and his buddies that were kicked out of Spain and England that were over residing in Amsterdam. So these bankers wanted to get back into the game. They're small time. They're in the minor leagues in Amsterdam. They fund this guy, Oliver Cromwell. They build him an army to take over and to help them get back, get a foothold in England. The leader of the money lending in Amsterdam gave Cromwell the support in return for allowing him to them the usury to return to England. And of course, he agreed. So Cromwell purges the House of Commons. There's normally 512 members. 50 members were left. He put King Charles I on trial. Not a single English lawyer would draw up a charge sheet because they knew he didn't do really anything wrong. Luckily, Cromwell had some lawyer buddies over there in Amsterdam who was giving him all his money to overtake the throne and bring back usury. And they took care of that. They wrote up the charge sheet. Charles was found guilty and executed in 1649. Here's the view of it. This is them charging him. Just a drawing for people listening. The crowd started chanting, "God save the king." And it wasn't Cromwell. They were saying that for their king and yelled as he was murdered. So Cromwell staged a coup to bring back usury into England. And I guess you could say also stop some violence between the two opposing religious groups. But regardless, usury came with that. So luckily, Cromwell, he became what's known as the protector, is in power. He holds a conference to obtain for approval for a large-scale immigration of the rest of these buddies in Amsterdam that funded his rise to power. And his followers said, "Please don't do this. How is enriching others instead of our own fellow countrymen good? Why are you doing this, Oliver? I thought you were a man of the people." And he said, regardless, he does it. Cromwell dies in 1658, succeeded by his son, Richard, who ruled for 9 months. And eventually, King Charles's son, the one that was killed, eventually takes power back and then passes the Encouragement of Coinage Act to promote trade and stuff like that. So King Charles sees the issue, his son sees the issues with usury, sees the issues with corruption like this. And he thought that this would be a good idea to take the country back. All right, I took it from the coup from Cromwell. Let's put this trade act in to help get the trade going again and the coining of money, blah, blah, blah. But it didn't work out anyway. It failed. He dies. His brother takes over. And James II, his brother, is the victim of propaganda galore. He's just in the press and in the streets and protesting him, all this stuff like that. So maybe if you forget this story when I talked about the Rothschilds. So James II, how we just talked, he's the brother of the recently killed king's son, blah, blah, blah. Well, so James II, he's trying to do his best. He's trying to do his best. And then his daughter, you know, she marries this guy named Prince William. Prince William. And James probably says, this guy is a freaking loser. But anyway, Prince William marries his daughter. And he's his daughter. Where'd the daughter marry the husband? Where did she meet him? You guys going to be able to guess? Amsterdam. Who was in Amsterdam? The same people that funded deposing James's uncle. So what are the odds that his daughter marries a prince from the same area that's causing all this strife and bringing usury back into England? So James had a far superior army to Prince William of Orange, but shockingly his advisors told him, don't attack him. He'll stop. Don't worry. He's your son-in-law. He's just joking. AKA his one advisor was John Churchill. He was the lead guy that said, "Oh, King James, your son-in-law, Prince William, he's amassed an army at our gates. I think they're just practicing. They're not going to attack you. Don't worry. Don't attack them. I know our army is better and more well-equipped." He'll go away. Do you think that's what happened? Did he go away? Totally coincidentally, John Churchill also was receiving a stipend of $6,000 from Amsterdam. Huh. And then I can tell you what, if this wasn't a payment for committing treason, I can't tell you what he was getting $6,000 for as a stipend from the place that's all these troubles are coming from. And he got more and more and more money, this John Churchill. If you want to see what John Churchill paid for in his treason, this beautiful, it's called Blenheim Palace, for those listening. And there's this beautiful lake here. It's this huge, huge beautiful palace, Blenheim Palace. Look it up. And that was John Churchill to help the guy that disposed of his king, the guy he was supposed to be advising for a guy that was going to allow corruption at unprecedented levels come into the country. And William of Orange, how I said it was the Rothschild story. William of Orange, Prince William, he was the Rothschilds were his financial advisors coming from this Hessian guy who was selling military people. They're all interconnected. It's a big mess. And I had it in my head and I lost it. But that's William of Orange's ties to them from the corruption there. Just so you know. Okay. So William of Orange, his military campaign, like that of William the Conqueror in 1066, were financed by these corrupt, evil usurers. And in return for the support of William III, he surrendered. So Prince William gets in, he deposes his father-in-law. Usury is back on the menu, baby. And that's a Lord of the Rings joke, kind of. I don't know. Anyway, he surrenders. His first action as king, he doesn't say, thank you, I'm sorry, I did this to save you. I did this for your betterment, people. Please respect me. No, the first thing he does is he surrenders the royal prerogative of issuing England's money free of debt and interest to the consortium known as the Governor and the Company of the Bank of England. This avalanche of usury started 33 years after Cromwell had let the money lending back into Britain. This was the nail in the coffin that propped up William of Orange, and the Bank of England was created. This privately owned central bank was fronted at first by a retired pirate, which is ironic, right? A retired pirate, William Patterson, fronted the bank like its original funds. So he robbed people of the oceans, and now he's robbing the people on land. Who would boast that the bank hath the benefits of interest on all monies, which it creates out of nothing? So he laughed. Just like how Joe Biden and all those people were laughing at the correspondence dinner about how prices are going up, how everything costs more, and he's laughing. He thinks it's a hilarious joke. Well, so did this guy who started that fronted the funds for the central bank, William Patterson. The interest of monies which we create out of nothing. In 1694, the bank opened, and I mean brilliant plans on knowing how much money could be made and the power that they would get controlled, right? I mean, that's one thing I will say. These people, they knew how to enslave a country. Everybody else at that time, because I'm just some stupid guy, I'd say, well, if I want to take that country, we got to take it by force. They realize, oh, we're a bunch of dorks, so we can't take it by force, but we can enslave it by just buying off a few people. So this bank in 1690, blah, blah, blah. So the bank opens and starts lending cash directly to William of Orange, their boy, at unlimited sums at 8% interest. So what does this allow William to do, William of Orange? It's the first country in Europe that has a fiat fake currency that can be created out of nothing. Not the first, but the biggest. Amsterdam and Holland was, I think there was a bank there a few, like 50 years previously. So this unlimited funding allowed England to finance war and prosecution of war against anyone they wanted on an unprecedented scale. King Louis XIV of France being the first example. So King Louis XIV, I think that's Prince William of Orange. Oh no, I think that might be him. This is Louis XIV. I'll make him bigger. He was the best. He's on my list, guys, of possible kings that we're going to get to run America. Reincarnation of sorts of him. So anyway, they had unlimited funds and they're fighting France, they don't have usury. They don't have a central bank. So the bank, the only winner of full scale war, might I add, would receive $100,000 from the crown, a $4,000 administration fee. Fine print, even back then in the 1600s, you got to read that fine print, baby. And the bank could also issue 1.2 million in banknotes without any gold to cover. So you're paying the industries to make your weapons, you're paying the soldiers, you're paying for the food on fake money, as you guys know, on fiat currency, without any gold in the storage to back up this money. So if people said, I want to exchange this for gold, which I'm sure they wouldn't let them do, it would collapse. The system would be over. And that's what our system's propped up by violence, just by wars. So this is what England had, this huge advantage over France. They have to pay for their weapons and their military. England doesn't. Now, so there was much opposition to this new Bank of England, by the way. The previous goldsmiths who were doing the fractional reserve banking, who were doing the 10, you know, 1 ounce giving out 10, they knew that this would stop, this Bank of England would totally wipe out their business, which it did. Also, many regular folk feared that the bank would grow too powerful and become the keystone of the commercial world. They got that right. This is exactly what happened, provided the framework for all the subsequent central banks that were replicated. Now, the story of how the bank charter was passed rings awfully close to the passing of the Federal Reserve. Again, the history rhymes. So how did they get the bank charter passed? Because many people, especially in this day, they didn't want to champion their own. They're having prosperity. They're having wealth. They're doing great. Why would you change it? People hate change. Even then, they hate to change even more, probably less change. So if you're doing well, people are, you're building beautiful structures, et cetera, et cetera. It's tough to get people to go behind a change. So how'd they do it? Well, this of the 514 members, it was split like half Tories, half Whigs, some independents. 20% were illiterate. So that helped. The bill was debated in 1694 in the high point of summer. Most of the rural members of the house were engaged in farming and summer pursuits, harvesting their crops. When the charter was granted, guess how many of the 514 members were there to pass the Bank of England charter? 42. 42 were there. And I told this story in my Rothschild episode because it's a lot of crossover, but this bill was pushed through in an act called the Tonnage of Ships and Vessels Act. And this is the exact same story we have in America. They passed this their own Bank of England charter by hiding it in all these pages of how they're charging new taxes on everything, windows, bachelors, wives, children, marriages, anything to help fund the war against France. But they snuck it in there. They snuck it in there. And since a lot of the people were illiterate, 90% weren't there, they corruptly pushed it through. Just like they did with our Federal Reserve Act. They did the same thing. It was Christmas Eve. It was 23rd evening. They said they were going to hold until Christmas, till this passed. Some were away. And it passed in 1913, the Federal Reserve Act. You know, ensuring our demise. And same story that happened here. Just crazy, right? That it's just, again, it's just they use the same tricks because we're not informed. We don't read. We don't, you know. But yeah, so also this Tonnage Act, also they put taxes on, like I said, literally everything. Like if you had three windows in your house, you got taxed more than two windows. But they also, on top of all those taxes, added a 20% tax on income. That's America. We tax everything. And I wouldn't be against taxes. I literally wouldn't if it was like bettering my community or bettering lives of my fellow countrymen or helping a dad that's working a blue collar job that supports four children and his wife. So the wife doesn't have to work. That's what I want my tax dollars to do. Whatever it's doing, I don't want it to go to Ukraine. I don't want it to fund shooting rockets into the dome. All right. So we talked about the Bank of England, just like ours being done the same thing. So the charger back charges, Pat, the charter passes, usury's back, currencies create out of nothing. It puts England in this unique position. They are now able to wage war on unlimited scale, not known to man. I want to share this channel. I hope it doesn't. Oh, thanks. Thanks, Ism. I really appreciate Houston Smallins. Thank you, dude. Thank you very much for the compliment. So now, like I said, war can be waged at an undone board before scale because now people don't need to pay for their weapons and their military. They got it, dude. They can fund it no matter what. They just need the bodies now, essentially. And you're not going to bankrupt or run out of money. You could bankrupt the company, but you'll just go into debt to the bankers, which they want. So you're already in debt to him. What does it matter? You're $100 million in debt. So a case could be made, in my opinion, that all wars since the Bank of England Charter has passed have been solely on the purpose of instituting Federal Reserves and central banking into any country. Imperial Germany, World War I, they didn't have a central bank, went to war. Imperial Russia, 1919 with the Bolsheviks, didn't have a central bank. Italy, Japan in World War II, didn't have central banks. Libya, 2001. Afghanistan, North Korea, even though it's, you know, on and on and on and on again. That's why wars are started, in my opinion. Or you have some resources that we need, and you also don't have a bank. So we want both. We want to extend our democracy to you both your ways. All the countries which had state banking systems distributed wealth on an equitable basis, provided standards of living far superior to their populations living under a central bank. And within 2 years of the Bank of England Charter in 1696, 1.7 million banknotes circulated with a gold reserve of 36,000. So they gave us they gave out 1.7 million in fiat currency with 36K to back it. This was the beginning of the end of economic prosperity in England, and or at least the writing was on the wall. The national debt had risen to 30 million because of the wars with France and others. Then add the American independence fight, which had been fought. Why did the independence fight happen? Was it because they really wanted that land? Or was it because the colonists had been using their own colonial script, not needing a central bank, getting wealthy beyond belief, still paying taxes, getting wealthy beyond belief? And the Bank of England said, the Rothschild said, no. You guys, you think you're just going to not have a central bank? We're going to war with you. And so England went to war with America to stop their free colonial script. The national debt soared to 176 million. In 1786, the Prime Minister, William Pitt, tried to abolish the national debt with a sinking fund, which generated like interest, blah, blah. It didn't work. And that plan was dumped after Napoleon, came onto the scene. The war lasted against France from 1792 to 1815. Just like how I told you wars are started for central banks, well, Napoleon had an interest-free system of finance that, again, just how I said wars are started to institute central banks. Napoleon in France was rocking without a central bank. Can't have that. England also waged another war to a central bank-free country, the United States, in 1812 to 1814. This war was instigated by England at the behest of Meyer Amschel, after the U.S. Congress refused to renew the charter of the Rothschild-controlled Bank of the United States, the central bank that was in the U.S. 1791 to 1811. The British Prime Minister, Spencer Percival, he tries to stop the War of 1812. He says, I'm the PM. Let's not do this. We don't want another war with America. We don't have the money. We're in debt. What happens to him? He gets shot in the lobby of the House of Commons and dies in 1812. You know who shot him, right? A lone gunman. Just a deranged lone gunman who has visited Russia and liked communist propaganda, or a failed actor who hates the president. Yeah, it was a lone guy. Again, it's the same story. It was this lone gunman who was a political radical, John Bellingham, who was paid by the one and only R. Kids. By 1815, the national debt had ballooned to $885 million. Not only money, the banker war lost 3 million in military, 100 million civilians. But listen, what they'll tell you is central banks save so many lives. So that's why we need to sacrifice your life to get another central bank so we can prop up more lives. They're just so friendly, dude, that central banks are the answer. That's what they do. So in order to destroy Napoleon's state bank, it cost the British public $831 million. Over which $2.5 billion of was still outstanding in 1914. This is a great example to show you. England is still in debt from 1694. Well, I guess like 1800 technically, but they're still owe money from 1800. But you expect that they know the countries are never going to get out of debt. And we're in $33 trillion of debt. We're never getting out of it. And so obviously these central bankers know that we're never getting out of it. They know we're not going to be able to escape this debt, just like England hasn't been able to escape it for 230 years. They've been in the same, oh, my light went off. But yeah, 250 years, they haven't been able to pay it. They, like I just said. So you see, central banks want the countries in debt. They say they know you can't get out of it, but that's the price you pay for stability. Look at all these economic depressions and crashes, the ones that they created, foreign agents created in places that didn't have central banks. It's such a scam. The central bankers of England would cause an economic chaos in America and keep doing it every so many years to say, see, you guys need us. You need us. You need us. These banks have created a previously foreign concept, starvation in the midst of abundance. I thought that was such a powerful. See you, Raven. Chris. Oh, what's up, Chris? Which countries don't have central banks now? I think, Chris, it is North Korea, probably Yemen, probably anywhere where there's trouble, there's no central bank. The Middle East, I'm sure there's some places without a central bank, maybe Afghanistan, maybe like, I don't know, but at least North Korea, I'm sure Yemen, there's a few places left, and they're always, that's why we fight them. So these banks have created, I talked about that. Now politicians fought back in England against the Bank of England. So in 1800, a detailed plan of honest politicians said, let's get off this. Let's convert England into a national bank like Napoleon. It failed, or they get killed. And at the start of World War One, debt stood already. At the start of World War One for England, debt was at 650 million. By March 1919, it increased to 7.4 billion. 3 billion is still outstanding 95 years later, an interest rate of 3.5% and none. At what point? I'm sure the interest rate's higher than the actual first loan. In 1919, 40% expenditure of the country was allocated to payment of interest. 40% was going to interest. World War II, debt rose again by 300%, 7.1 billion in 1939. 20.1 billion in 1945. And as of March 2017, Britain stands at 1.8 trillion, really $5 trillion of debt. Most of it interest, most of it interest. And that's the stability we pay for. Our ancestors died for, or were deceived about to operate in these countries. In 1946, the Labour Party in the UK, you know, party of the working man, just like our Democratic Party, we're the blue collar class, blah, 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 blah. They nationalized the Bank of England. The usury stopped. It's like that meme. We nationalized the Bank of England, you know, like the Anakin and Leia or whatever, Anakin and whoever, Padme. We've nationalized the bank. You mean usury's over with? And he doesn't make a face. It's over with, right? No, it did absolutely nothing. It was propaganda for the Labour Party. It did not nationalize in any way, shape, or form. Damn, I took so long doing those two episodes. We have Napoleon chapter up. It's 4 pages. I think we're just going to do it like tomorrow or Monday. We're going to do it Monday, and I'll have Russia in there next time too. All right, guys. So I got a little Saturday. I don't know if it was the lights. I hope you guys did everyone learn something in the chat? I hope we got a little bit of better idea on the central bank. I know that topic's been done to death, but I thought it was interesting going back to Rome, how the Bank of England charter started, because I've never really heard that talked about before. War is a racket. Absolutely is. Did you hear that quote? I said, starvation in the midst of abundance. That's what central banks do. Maybe that's a great title. Starvation in the midst of abundance. But yeah, so next episode, I'll do it Monday. I'm going to do Napoleon and Russia. And Napoleon, dude, he was such a badass. I mean, Napoleon, history always rewrites these people that if they tried to do good for their people, I mean, think of like the guy in Guatemala that the CIA overthrew. They wrote him as a communist, whatever, abuser, whatever, whatever. Afghanistan. They did the same thing. They just do it over and over again. Who's the guy in Libya? Gaddafi. I don't know much about Gaddafi, but I heard he was doing all these good things for the people. They say he's killing his own going populist. Napoleon, they write off as a comical historical character. He's short. He's pathetic. World domination. That's what he said. He wasn't going for world domination. He was trying to keep the bankers out of his country. He was awesome. Oh, Billy Ray Valentine is in the chat. Oh, my God. What, am I in heaven? Did I pass away? Well, Billy, I'm just done. We just talked about how the central banks started in Rome and then in England. And so we're going to do Napoleon next show. All right, guys. So I'm Jack Allen. Go follow me at Kojak Podcast on Instagram or Twitter. If you want to support the show, I have a Patreon or Venmo, but I totally get it. Times are tough because of the central banks stealing money from all of us. So if you can leave a review or just come watch the show when I do my streams, that is just as valuable as the $2 or whatever it is. So thanks, guys. Go check out Billy Ray Valentine, my boy. He's an OG of the game. And you guys have a good night. All right. Much love. God bless. Thanks for listening. I'll be on Monday. Talk to you Monday. Peace.